All right. Hello and welcome to the Town Mile Podcast. It has been a few months since our last episode, so we are very excited to be back at it tonight, hitting record and getting a good conversation going. On this episode, we tracked down the author of a great book that recently Matthew and I both read called The Wax Pack. Brad Baluchian, who is the best-selling author. It is on the LA Times bestseller list, or was at one point, but Brad took some time, met with us, and talked to us about his book. Basically, the premise is this. He bought a pack of 1986 Topps baseball cards a few years back, and of the 15 cards in there, made it a priority to track down all 15 players in this pack. Guys like Randy Reddy, Dan Carman, Carlton Fisk is in this pack, Dwight Gooden and his experience driving for several months cross country all over the place to sit down with all of these retired baseball players and talk about their experiences, what they're doing now, their life experiences, their families. All of it is in this book, and it really took a very deep, beautiful meaning into the beauty of baseball. And those who appreciate it, I like to consider myself a longtime baseball nerd, but he really, really put out a beautiful book. And we couldn't be more excited to have him join us. I had sent him an email. I was almost inspired by his experience of reaching out to each of these ball players kind of out of the blue and saying, you know, hey, I got a project, this book project. And I reached out to him kind of that same way. Hey, we got to do a podcast. Would love to have you on, talk about your book. And sure enough, he responded and said, absolutely. So Brad seems like a great dude. He's a class of 98 guy like myself. So we certainly had a real good connection, but really it was super generous of him to take some time and talk to a couple strangers that he's never met before. You know, we got on a Zoom call and recorded it. And he gave us, you know, about 50 minutes just talking baseball, talking about his book. So I don't believe there's any spoilers in there in this book, or excuse me, in this episode that spoil anything in the book. So if you if you're looking for not only a great baseball book, but just a great book about a person's journey to overcome things and overcome obstacles, and a book about relationships with family and with parents and with fathers and just with the game of baseball, it kind of all tied together beautifully into a wonderful book, a beautiful book. So couldn't recommend this book anymore. And we're very excited to get this going. So hope you enjoy our conversation with Brad. He had kind of been on all kinds of interviews, and we saw him on MLB TV, you know, getting interviewed with John Smoltz, the Hall of Fame pitcher. So he's had some great press. Just looking at the back of it, you know, he gets props from George F. Will. He gets props from Jeff Perlman, really just amazing journalists, in that world, in the baseball world, in the sports world. So salute to Brad, and hope you enjoy, guys. Thanks for taking the time. Let's do this. Here's Brad Baluchian. Thanks for doing this, man. I honestly was kind of inspired by, you know, you just reaching out to these guys and these strangers in your book, and it's like, oh, I'll probably, we'll see what happens. I'll email him and see what he says. And
yeah, so. No, I mean, I always think about that. Like, if people have contacted me, it's like, I'm on the other side of that now. So
yeah,
I want to, you know, treat people the way that I would hope the people had treated me.
Sure. So
I always try to get back to everybody. Yeah.
Sure. That's awesome. So you're at Merritt College in Oakland. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I teach cool. there. Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. So you're the director of natural history and sustainability. What is that? And what's that entail?
It's basically a program to train students to get jobs working in the environment. So working at parks, you know, working in the outdoors, you know, educating people about nature, animals and plants, and
got it.
Anything in the environmental sector, really.
Gotcha. So do you consider yourself like, so is writing like a,
I have two very different sort of parts of my career. Like there's the scientist teaching part, and then there's the writing part. And before this book, most of my writing had been about science, and then this book was, you know, very much unrelated. And now I'll probably go back and do more of this, the science, more writing more about science. I've always had kind of, I used to work for a magazine. I've done journalism at different times in my career and always liked having both of them in my life.
Got it. So, I mean, I guess we could just, well, I think Matt just tried to text me. He said, hold on, give me a minute. But Balukjian, is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Because I think I saw a video on YouTube where, I don't know, it was like John Smoltz and Kinney. Was it Brian Kinney?
No, Smoltz and Robert Flores.
That's awesome. Yeah. So I think that's where I heard how to say your name. I live in South Philly, and I've been telling a lot of my, you know, one thing I like about Philly is I've always considered myself, you know, a baseball nerd. Kind of growing up the same, probably about the same. So I graduated high school in 98.
Yeah, same year.
You're 90, class of 98. That's great.
You're a Phillies fan yourself?
Well, I grew up in South Dakota. So my dad was a huge Yankee fan when I was a kid.
Right.
So the Yankees were, so my formative, I guess, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, the Yankees were terrible. Yeah. And the Twins were awesome. So every May, my dad would drive, you know, my cousin and I, or my sister and I, you know, to, we'd go to the Metrodome and watch the Yankees get smoked by the Twins, you know, out to the hotel.
Like, that's like Ken Herbeck and Dan Gladden and that era, right?
Yeah. I mean, we just went to a game here on Tuesday, and I was thinking the first game I ever saw, Shane Mack of the Twins hit an inside the park home run.
Nice.
And I haven't seen it. And I've probably been to, you know, I don't know, a couple hundred ball games, and I've never even close seen an inside the park home run since.
It's so rare.
That old AstroTurf, you know, when the ball just kind of zipped. So I grew up, you know, I'm unapologetically a Yankee fan. I mean, I used to have to, you know, when we went to our college years, they seemed like they won just about every World Series. So, but no, I mean, living in Philly, I mean, I think, you know, if my partner in crime gets on me, he hates the Yankees. Like, people hate the Yankees, and it's okay.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things I think I was, you know, I was just drawn to, you know, your book was, it wasn't really about, you know, hating a team. It was more about kind of the connection of a ballpark. So maybe we can just get into that. Like, just talk about how did this come about, you know, the project of actually doing a book for this?
Yeah. I've always, so the type of journalism,
there's Matt jumping on.
Do you want me to wait or?
No, maybe if we give him a sec, see if he can join. How are we doing, Matt? Yeah. Hey,
sorry, guys. Oh, my God.
No, it's all right.
I'm so sorry. Had to update the browser here.
Link was so working. Matt's got a great mustache.
Yeah, I love the Hulk Hogan style look going.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So, Matt, we were just talking about how much the Yankees are loved in Philly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, not as much love as the Mets have, but there's some love there.
Well, great, man. Well, we'll get, I mean, we got Brad Bellucci in here, the author of the Wax Pack. I don't think we're going to publish this video. This is more kind of an audio, but Matt and I, like I said, I was about halfway through it, and I was like, dude, you got to read this book. And I don't remember how I saw, like I follow some card collecting Twitter stuff, you know, and I kept seeing it kind of pop up. So why don't you just kind of tell us about that? Like how did the project get started for you? How did you get motivated to do this?
So I was trained in journalism in college. The type of writing that I was trained in was they call magazine journalism or creative nonfiction. A style that got popular in the 60s and 70s of that kind of writing nonfiction in a way that has the same qualities of fiction, that, you know, you were telling a story, you've got characters, you've got dialogue. And I've always wanted to have a chance to do that kind of writing and to do it in a long form way. So nowadays with magazines not being very common or popular, you know, books are kind of the last place to do that. So I'd always, like, as a writer and a journalist, had the desire to write a book. And for me, the idea came to me of kind of revisiting my childhood, and because I was always curious about those players that I grew up watching, and I collected thousands of cards and, you know, spent so much time with my baseball cards. And I always liked the guys that were not the star players. I always liked the underdog players. And I always loved that theme of where are they now? And so I've been kicking around this question in my head for a long time about, like, oh, I wonder what happened to those players that I grew up watching. And then I just kind of had one of those inspiration moments where I thought, you know, getting a pack of baseball cards would be the perfect device for writing about those guys that I grew up collecting. That, you know, in a single pack of cards, you get a random sample. And most of those guys are going to be the type of journeymen and underdogs that I liked the most as a kid. So kind of the randomness of a pack and the surprise of who's in the pack was the sort of the catalyst for the whole thing. It was like, I could just imagine a book being structured around a single pack. And the similarity between, you know, a pack of baseball cards has 15 cards, a book has about 15 chapters. It just seemed like, you know, it would be a great device. And so that it was really, I mean, the idea came first of, like, you know, could I do this? And then it just became like, okay, well, now I have to sort of figure out if I'm going to go through with this, the logistics, and okay, going to get a pack. How am I going to find these guys? What kind of book am I going to write? I mean, the idea, I think, is an attractive one in and of itself, but then how you actually execute it, that was the next set of questions I had to answer.
Got it. So you kind of always wanted to write a book, or just kind of thought, just kind of in writing. I mean, I guess I can resonate with that as well. I was a journalism major as well in college. But I guess it was more about me not even just knowing where to start. I didn't really have a plan, but I read somewhere 38 times rejected.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's that process like?
So I had a background in journalism. I mean, I after college, I worked for a magazine. I freelanced for many magazines and newspapers and websites. I had worked at the LA Times on the science desk. So it wasn't like I had no experience in journalism. I had just never written a book before. And writing a book is kind of a different animal, because you have to first try to find an agent if you want to try to get a book deal. And it's first you have to convince an agent to represent you. And then the agent is the person that shops your book with the publishers. And there's basically five major companies in New York that control all of the, you know, major book publishing in the country. So it's a hard thing to break into, because then you have to try to get a deal from one of those companies. So the reason why there was such a lag between when I took the road trip for the book in 2015 and the book coming out last year was that I kept getting rejected by those publishing companies. And it was frustrating, because it wasn't that they didn't think it was good. You know, they would say, oh, this is a great idea, it's great writing, but basically no one knows who you are, or no one cares about these players anymore, or You know, we just don't think there's a big enough market for this. I mean, many different reasons why they didn't think it would sell. And it's all economics. It's all money. You know, if they don't think that they can sell X number of books in a certain amount of time, they're not going to give you a book deal. So I had gone through two different agents and was basically told, I think this is dead in the water. And I decided, like, well, I think I never stopped believing that it would be a good book and that it would sell. And so I went on my own at that point and just directly approached the University of Nebraska Press, because they are known to do a lot of baseball books. And sure enough, literally I emailed Rob Taylor, one of the editors there. And within like 3 or 4 hours, he was writing back to me saying, it's great. I love it. I'm going to try to, you know, let's do it. And so at least at that point I had a deal, but it was not, you know, University of Nebraska Press is a small press. So I wasn't given very much money up front.
Okay. Is that based out of Lincoln?
Yeah, in Lincoln.
Okay. So there was never, I guess that was a question I was thinking. So you just never really doubted, you know,
I think anytime you get rejected 38 times, you do doubt, you know, there's no way you can't, have some pretty, demoralizing moments in there. But it was like, the reasons I was being given were not the core reasons, which would be like, this isn't good or this isn't good writing. It was these practical things. And I just felt like, well, if I can just get a chance to prove myself, I never stopped believing that the book would resonate if I just was given a chance.
Yeah.
The book is, the whole process you're explaining is like your whole love of underdogs in a way. It's just like,
yeah, it's funny.
Your whole, you're just trying to get the book get going, and it's like an underdog story in a way.
That's exactly right. I mean, awesome, I remember before it even came out, I was talking to my editor and I said, hey, like, I realized my book has now become the very underdog that it celebrates.
Yeah.
And so I started kind of almost positioning it in the promotion as like the Don Carmen of books, or the, you know, it, you know, and capitalizing on the fact that, yeah, this was overlooked and underappreciated, but now, you know, let's make it an underdog success story.
Yeah. No, I find myself, even in, you know, what I do for a living, I work for a public health company. I do like recruitment strategy. So I talk to a lot of like college, soon to be college grads, or maybe college grads that are, hey, I've been applying for jobs for 2 months. I'm not hearing anything. Yeah. And having to have that, like, you know what, you just you're going to get it. You just need that yes, no matter. And then all that anxiety kind of goes away, you know? So it's just kind of believing in what you're doing. I mean, that can be very hard, but, you know, once you reach where you want to go, I think in terms of at least getting a book or you get a job offer then all of a sudden right. It's like, okay.
And I think it also, like, I don't advocate for sort of blind ambition in the sense of like, you have to be honest also with yourself, right? Like, I mean, there have been ideas that I've had where I know, like, okay, this is maybe not the best.
Yeah.
So you have to be, you know, have enough self-awareness to say, okay, this one is really good, and I'm going to hitch my wagon, and I'm going to die on that sword. But not all your ideas are going to be like that. And so, you know, don't, in other words, like, I, in thinking about giving advice and talking to young people, like, I would never say, like, you're always going to be right. You're always going to get it.
Sometimes
you have to know when to quit, and you know, okay, this time I'm not going to succeed with this, you know?
Yeah. Or I think, you know, in terms of like young college students, that it's like, hey, you're going to probably get an offer for a job you may not like.
Right.
But you got to start somewhere. So that's, I mean, that's like, I said in the email, like, the kind of the romanticism of going to ball games is what I think you really captured, you know. And I don't know if you'd read Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn.
Yeah.
That's, in fact, what it,
I had, on this trip, I on the road trip itself, I actually well, I listened to it on those long stretches of driving that I did. And it was, I kept that book in mind the whole time, like that my book was trying to be kind of like a modern day Boys of Summer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at least from my perspective, that's, you succeed. I mean, you did just that, you know, where I think there's just, these guys are, they're not all in terms of, I guess, being a Brooklyn Dodger, 1955, you know, whatever the case is, those guys are guys that live in Michigan and Missouri and Nebraska. You know, they're sometimes not even defined by being, maybe they're not even as beloved as, or maybe they don't even care about being a Dodger as much as like Dodger fans do, you know? So there's kind of an element, you know, element to that. I guess, how important was that for you to address kind of that deep meaning that baseball can have?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point of the book is rooted in the power of baseball. At some point in the book, I talk about, you know, that I think baseball has a popularity problem that they should address by actually doubling down on the unique nature of the game being slow. So, you know, we keep hearing about how baseball is too slow, whatever. And yeah, I think we can do things to make sure the game doesn't get too long. Mm-hmm. But baseball will always be slower than football and basketball and hockey. And, you know, it's just the nature of the game. So rather than fight that, I think we should embrace baseball being this weird sort of anachronistic, you know, slow-paced game. But embrace the fact that because it's slow, it creates this perfect environment for building relationships. You know, and whether that means going to a game with someone you care about and having the space and the time to talk about stuff that you're, you know, in life, or it means playing catch with someone you love. I mean, I think baseball is the backdrop, you know, for exploring and building relationships. And that's kind of the meaning of the book. You know, the book is more about relationships between fathers and sons and between husbands and wives and between, you know, friends and between coworkers. And I mean, that's kind of why I also opened and closed the book with the people in the Topps factory that manufactured the cards, because I wanted to show that the power of baseball extends well beyond the people that play the game all the way to the people that literally manufactured these baseball cards. And that 30 years later, when I found the factory workers, they and observed them hanging out with each other, it was the same camaraderie that you would observe if you saw a bunch of former baseball players reuniting and hanging out.
Yeah, like you go to work with somebody, you share things and families and just experiences. So, no, I thought that was, you know, just something that was really, you know, and not only that, but just your kind of how you articulated, I think, your experiences, even with, you know, the relationship with your dad and with OCD, yeah. Kind of how you.
That was another thing, was like me being in the book, you know, which some people, you know, have not. In getting feedback, you know, there are some people that really don't like that part. And I tell people, like, if you want just a straight baseball history book or stats book, like, don't buy my book, because it's not that kind of book.
Yeah.
And I made a point to talk about, yeah, my relationship with my ex-girlfriend and my dad and my anxiety disorder. And, you know, but in all those cases, I felt like I wasn't sharing that just to share it. I was sharing it to show a parallel between someone. I mean, I'm just an average guy, right? And showing that there are parallels between those things in my life and the things that Major League Baseball players deal with, and therefore that all of us deal with. That, you know, there's a sort of universal experience, shared experience that we all have as people, that you might not really realize until you have a chance to really dig into who these players are as people.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Like Randy Reddy. It was funny, the, you know, that you're, cause that's a reaction that I would think most, I guess, guys older than us would have with something like, I mean, fortunately, I guess I bet I just missed the, you know, Tinder and that sort of thing. Right. You know what I'm saying? So when I met Steph, my now wife, but But that would have been, you know, anybody's react, you know, it's like, what the hell? Like, that's, you can just swipe, you know, that's kind of the everyman.
Well, and I think that chapter, I mean, that chapter maybe more than any other chapter in the book captures the range of tone and topic and emotion that the book tries to encompass. And that in that one chapter, you have the really kind of fun, you know, the stuff about dating and Tinder and, you know, me showing Randy Reddy how to use Tinder, all the way to the other end, which is like this sort of terribly tragic story, yeah, about his first wife and, you know, having this heart attack and what happened, you know, the anticipation and the question of what happened to her that kind of hangs over that whole chapter until, yeah, the very end when I finally bring it up. And I mean, that's what I was aiming to do, was to hit all those spots, you know, so you got the fun, you've got the lighthearted, but also the very heavy and the serious.
Yeah. Like how, and that's one of the things, I guess, since I've gotten, you know, to be in, as I journey, you know, as you know, into our 40s, like you learn how to, you got to keep moving forward. Sometimes you got to learn to live with things that aren't always, you know, how you think they're going to be and that sort of thing. So, and I noted in there, you know, Don Mattingly is probably my favorite guy of all time. I mean, he was kind of my original Eddie Vedder. Can you, yeah, kind of walk us through, if Don Mattingly would have been pulled in that pack, like what would you really have tried to do to meet, to connect with Don Mattingly,
yeah, at that time? So Don Mattingly, you know, a huge star, like, so he was on the level of his, he's probably like an equivalent to a Doc Gooden, right? He's not, yeah, a Hall of Famer like Carlton Fisk, who was in the pack. More successful than a Vince Coleman, who was also a star. So I'd say, like, if we're going to rank the like, you know, celebrity of these guys, Don Mattingly and Doc Gooden are kind of similar. Mm-hmm. And Doc, so when I opened up the pack and I got someone like a Doc Gooden, I was like, okay, like, kind of like, well, shit, this is going to be tough, like, because these guys are big stars. So I'm sure if I had seen Mattingly, I'd be like, okay, it's going to be a challenge. At the same time, I actually don't, maybe you can tell me, I don't really know. I knew Fisk had a kind of a negative reputation. I knew that Gooden had a reputation around all the addiction stuff. I don't really know. I mean, Mattingly, you know, I've never heard many bad things about, but, I guess not knowing his reputation, I would have probably just done some research about, like, what were the writers that covered him saying about him? I mean, do you know, like, what was he known as?
I think it, I mean, listen, he's from Evansville, Indiana. He's from a small, you know, small community, from what I've seen. So Sweeney Murdy is one of the, you know, and a lot of the guys that cover the Yankees, that they just speak, you know, just, there's never been a bad, you know, kind of term about Don Mattingly. I mean, other, yeah, than, I don't know what it, you know, so I've never heard it. So that's why I feel like because, yeah, he may have been with the Dodgers at that time managing, but I think with, you know, with, right, Mattingly across the board, it's almost like he's been so well liked that people think he should really be a Hall of Famer, but,
right,
I don't think he probably is a Hall of Famer, but I just think his reputation and the way he kind of went about his business after, yeah, his back injury and still played for, you know, I don't know, 8-9 years with a horrible back, that, you know, that would have been a piece that would have been very easily applied into this book.
Well, I would have probably, I mean, what I did with all of them was, you can get everyone's home address from the autograph collector lists. So I wrote a letter, like an old school letter, explaining the project. And then, there are certain databases, you can, you know, public records databases that often have people's phone numbers. Of course, like, it's a lot easier when they have a landline than a, you know, it's hard to get a cell phone number, but a, yeah, lot of these guys had landlines. So I would have probably written to him and then followed up with a phone call, see if that got me anywhere. If he was with the Dodgers, I would have, you know, if, I mean, I always would go to, like, I would always go the official PR route only as a last resort.
Yeah.
But if I wasn't able to get to him directly through my own tactics, I would have then reached out to the Dodgers. You know, I would have done all, I mean, you'd be surprised what you can turn up in terms of connections just from really diligent Google research. trying to find people connected to him. I'm sure because he was a star player, he's got like an agent or he's got somebody representing him. So I'd probably go to that third party, like Gooden had and Fisk had. And I, you know, at that point, I mean, who knows whether he would have said yes or not, but
yeah, right.
It's just, it is harder to get to those guys that were those star players.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was telling you, when my dad would take us to the hotel. So I got his autograph. I think it was like a seventh grader. He had a leather Planet Hollywood jacket on. And I remember that was right when Planet Hollywood was like starting to blow up.
That was shit at that time. Probably.
And it looked awesome. Oh, he looked, he was like, what are you doing out of school? Cause it was like a Tuesday or it was like maybe a late end of the week series. And I was like, and I was honest, I got all my homework done. I was like, no, dude, I promise I got all my homework done. Like, I'm good. But he's like, what are you doing out of school? Yeah. Like, so no,
he treated you well. Like, that was
Yeah. He signed for my dad. And, you know, they all did. The only guy that didn't was Jimmy Key. And he ended up he told me that he's like, I don't sign in hotel rooms or I don't sign in hotel lobbies. He said, it's like, I'm small town from South Dakota. I don't know what the hell a hotel lobby is, you know?
Yeah. You know, with the thing with autographs, like I think not signing for kids, like, I mean, you got to sign for kids, you know?
Yeah.
So we were with and I probably told Matt this 100 times, but we got Danny Tartable's autograph as he was doing it. It was right outside the bus, and Paul O'Neill, it was his first year with the Yankees, got on the bus, and my cousin and I said, can you see if Paul O'Neill will come off and sign our baseballs? Yeah. And sure enough, Paul O'Neill came right out. So ever since then, right off the bat, my dad was like, oh, what an awesome guy Paul O'Neill is, you know, even before he became, you know, Paul O'Neill, you know, the Warrior and all that kind of stuff. So, great. Another piece I really liked a lot, it was almost, you know, kind of envious of, was that you just got to sit and watch a ball game with Tempe, with Gary Templeton.
But as it said in the book, he actually did not enjoy that very much.
Oh, right, right.
Well, I was just saying, so I should say that, yeah, there were two things. We were watching like the I think it was the Padres and the, was it the Giants? And we just watched a little bit, and that's when he was dissecting Matt Kemp. Yeah, that was cool. Like he was just kind of like breaking down what was wrong with his swing. But, you know, it was clear that Tempe was not a guy that would sit there and watch 9 innings, you know?
Yeah.
Which is so funny to me that I think a lot of guys are like that. They're like, I don't have time for that. When that's what they did their entire, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah. But
then, at least get that sample, you know, of him just giving you something that you haven't, that you don't notice.
I put in like game 2 or something of the 84 NLCS. And it was Padres and the Cubs. I had like an old DVD. I wanted to watch one of his games with him. And I had actually done this with Rance Mullenix, it's really fun to watch an old game with one of these players, and they ask them to kind of dissect it for you. And Rance was really great. And Tempe was like, I mean, granted, I didn't pick the best game. They lost like 10-0 or something. And after like a couple of hitters, he's like, turn this shit off. Like, right. He did no interest in watching that game. He's like, I know what happened. It sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I think if you see enough baseball, you kind of pick up on, I think that's something like, but just to have a big leaguer tell you, you know, or kind of have that insight, you know, and share that with.
Yeah.
So you never got, so Dwight Gooden, I mean, I don't, because that would have been, and I think you may have noted this, was that about the time of the Doc and Darryl 30 for 30?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the epilogue, I wrote about that. Like right after I was there was when they were filming that. And then, you know, basically I put 2 and 2 together when that was all happening, and he no-showed that he must have relapsed.
Yeah.
And that documentary basically infers that he relapsed.
Yeah. It was a rough, I mean, compared to Darryl, like Darryl seemed like he somewhat had his stuff together for the most part. And Doc was,
He's a pastor now? Isn't Daryl Strawberry a pastor or reverend?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I haven't, you know, and not that I want to, you know, and it's almost kind of scary because you think about, it's like, because you almost think like, how is this guy going to live in the next couple of years? But I think Dwight Gooden's done still at it for the most part.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, I remember seeing that he did go into like rehab again, like last year or something, or he got arrested again. I mean, you know, that's Gooden's story, right? It's just back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah. And his son almost had that burden, had to carry that.
Yeah. Well, so in a way, I don't regret not meeting with Gooden because he gave me the space to tell his story in a completely new way, which was to focus on his son and to kind of, that was a different angle, right? The challenge with writing about Gooden is there's been so much already written about him.
Yeah.
How do you do something new? And, you know, in an hour interview with him, would I really have uncovered that, you know, anything new? I don't know, but I know that with his son, that was all new stuff.
Yeah.
And his son, you know, you can really kind of get at the pain of that story by talking to his son.
Sure. Sure. Are we doing okay for time? Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. I mean, this is kind of how, I mean, Matt and I have done about 40 of these podcasts, or maybe, you know, or not even, I mean, I don't even think of it as podcasts. It's just like kind of telling stories and, you know, kind of shooting the shit a little bit. So that was, but going to, I mean, that was, it almost made my jaw hit the floor on that Doc and Daryl documentary when he was talking about when he retired with the Yankees. He's like, it hit me. It's like, I don't have to get drug tested anymore.
Yeah.
He's like, that was like euphoric for us. Like, holy shit. You know, what does this guy really have to live with every day? You know? So,
yeah.
What do we got, Matt? You got any, you good?
Well, you know, I really resonated with your love of underdogs because I grew up, you know, in the Philadelphia area, and I grew up in, you know, in the mid 2000s, and I was a Phillies fan like you are. Mm-hmm. And the teams I grew up with were all awful until you know, Ryan Howard and Chase Utley and, you know, all those teams started coming about. So I really loved that. You know, I remember going to a Veterans Stadium in the summer. My grandparents, you know, my mom grew up in, my parents grew up in South Philly, and my grandparents lived two blocks actually from the whole stadium complex down there, and they would take us to games, you know, business person specials in the afternoons, and watch Travis Lee and Tomas Perez and all those guys. And
is that like Pat Burrell era?
Pat Burrell. So I wanted to mention Pat Burrell because you have, you know, you like Don Carmen, kind of like not a no-name guy in a way. Yeah. And Pat Burrell, probably one of my favorite baseball players of all time.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
I always like Pat Burrell too. I love
Pat Burrell. I think the legend of his like sexual conquest off the field, I guess, kind of resonated with me in a way. And I was like really cool.
When he went to San Francisco, which I live in Oakland, and you know, he had a couple years here.
Yeah.
And he had that whole thing where he like, yeah, he was just such a character. By that time he was like a veteran and everything, but
right.
And him, you know, and Brian Wilson and all that was
hilarious. I just love that about the book. And you know, when the Phillies do a Wall of Fame every year,
yeah,
they literally just put anybody on the Wall of Fame at this point. And Pat Burrell was like 5 years ago, I guess, when he retired, maybe probably longer than that now. I got tickets right away. I was like, I love Pat Burrell. I got to go. Yeah. To it. You know, they drove him around in the car and stuff like that. So I loved that part of the book. And, it just really hit home with me because I love those no name guys, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, they're also like, I think there's just a lot more, they're more interesting to write about because their stories haven't been told, you know, they're not as corrupted by fame, and they're just more, I think, more relatable than the guys that were like the big stars.
Right.
And it seemed like for the most part all those guys that you're describing all seemed like they genuinely were happy to talk to you. Is that what you found?
I'm just thinking about if anybody, I mean, like the one who maybe wasn't as receptive was Richie Hebner. But he was also coaching, and it's different when you're like still coaching, and it was before a game, and right. You know, you're not going to, I get it. Like, he was focused on his job.
Right.
Did you ever find out what happened with him and his brother? I know there was like a whole,
well, I know what happened with him and his brother, and it's not, I mean, I just didn't put it in the book because I, you know, Dennis told me not to, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
It was off the record. And I'll tell you guys, like, it's not anything that interesting.
Okay.
like, you know how you all have family dynamics and someone yeah. doesn't get along with someone because of some stupid, you know, it's one of those things. It's not like a major, you know, issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think, gotcha. I think the point there is that, you know, rather than kind of hash it out, those guys, like the way they handle it is just like, let's just not talk about it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Was there like Gary Pettis, or did you ever hear from any of those guys, either Pettis or Fisk, since? I know you wrote the book.
Yeah, none of the guys that I didn't talk to, I heard from. You know, I Pettis is the one that I would most want to talk to, because I think he, you know, it wasn't really his choice. He was told to not talk to the media by the manager, AJ Hinch. But Pettis, being from Oakland, where I live, he went to the college that I used to teach at. I think I would just find him interesting to talk to. With Fisk, you know, I always think like, okay, like, I'm just hoping I never get a call from his agent again, because, you know, in the book I talked about how she, you know, she called me and was upset with me when I blogged about.
I was pumped how you handled that. I was reading that up and, you know, before going to bed, I was stoked how you handled that.
When she called me
in the book. Yeah. You're just kind of like, wait a second. Like, no, like, you're like, I'm not wrong. Like, what did I do? Like, I just want to talk to him.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, when she started saying all the stuff about like, well, he's got a grandson with Down syndrome, I'm like, well, I'm sorry, that's unfortunate, but like, what does that have to do with him talking to me? You know?
Right. Like, how are you supposed to know that? Like, you're just supposed to, oh, he, you know, how would you know that? How would you, you know? So well, I was excited how you handled that. That yeah, part of the book.
Yeah. Thanks. And I know, again, with Fisk, it's not, I was not out to like bury anybody. I just, you know, even with Fisk, my whole attitude was like, if you or he are concerned about how you're being portrayed, then just talk, you know, tell me what you want me to know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm only able to go on the weight of the evidence that I can collect. And, you know, I do all my research and I say, okay, all the things that have been written about Fisk, here's generally what they say. I'm just going to put that out there.
You know. What is it like in high school? He averaged like 20 rebounds or 25 rebounds. He was kind of a beast playing hoops.
But also, like, I tried to be fair there and include that story about, you know, maybe part of why he is who he is. There's that story of when he was in the state championship in basketball and he scored like 40 points and 30 rebounds. And right after the game, the first thing his dad said to him was like, oh, you missed two free throws.
Yeah. Right.
There you go.
Like, think about how those boys, you know, had it back then. I mean, you know, having dads that were, would that have been like World War II era? Maybe they're coming home from World War II, or there's a depression or something like that. They don't give a shit about, you know, your son's feelings. Like, you missed two shots. You know, like, that's.
Yeah. I mean, that's the attitude. Was exactly like, you know, your feelings are not to be embraced. They're to be suppressed.
Yeah.
Right.
That's, now that I'm thinking in, you know, my, I guess I don't, I'm thinking about, cause I'm about to be, well, not about to be my, you know, we're expecting our first child. And those are the things that now, when I think about those things, I'm like, oh shit. Like, how, I hope I don't screw that up, you know?
Well, and I think that one of the bright spots of the book is that although there were many fathers of these players that were, you know, kind of shitty dads, basically all the guys that I met with were really good dads. And so they, you know, Randy Reddy talking about his six sons, and Don Carmen bragging about his sons, you know, being such a special kid, and Steve Yeager getting to meet his son in the actual restaurant where we met. You know, I don't think I didn't meet any of these guys where they seemed like they had repeated history from their
family. Yeah. Right. And even Yeager, man, he quit drinking, right? Didn't he quit drinking?
Like cold turkey, yeah. Like in like right after you retired?
It's like, I'm done, you know, just apply that, you know, just that mental, you know, stuff. Yeah. I thought that Sutcliffe, it was cool to, you know, how cool Rick Sutcliffe was to you.
Yeah, no. And he was a guy that, you know, again, a bigger name. Cy Young winner. I mean, kind of like a Mattingly level, maybe not.
Yeah.
Quite,
yeah.
But, you know, but he's still on ESPN. And yeah, he was very, down to earth, you know, and very easy to talk to and just fun and unfiltered.
Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah.
Are there any guys that you still like keep in touch with?
Yeah. Don Carmen, who's kind of, I guess, maybe the star of the book in many ways. My favorite player. He and I still text here and there.
That's awesome.
I actually saw him in spring training last year, right before the lockdown.
That's awesome.
That's cool. Cause that in the book, it really sounded like you guys had like a real good connection there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool. That's cool to know that you guys are still, you know, talking.
Yeah. And then Rance Mullenix, Gary Templeton, Randy Reddy. Those are the guys that Lee Mazzilli, still in, you know, occasional touch with them.
That's really awesome.
That's really cool.
Is there things that you took from like this process? I mean, other than, you know, obviously these relationships with baseball, but is there things that you think like it did with your path with your, as a director, as working at Merritt College? Are there takeaways you had that you feel like you've applied or it's helped you even in your career, you know, at the college?
I don't know, not in a direct way, but I teach a class in training, and I run a program which is preparing students for jobs working in outdoors and in parks and in nature, environmental world. And I teach a class in how to get a job, basically a careers class. And I think the lesson that I like to share with them is that there's a lot to be said for taking an unusual approach in your career, or taking a sort of non-traditional approach, in that like most of the jobs that I've had have not been jobs that were advertised or that I traditionally applied for or even existed. A lot of my jobs were like things that I made up and then pitched as like, there's a need for this, let's do this. Or, you know, basically showed my value and my passion and then convinced the employer to create a job. And so I always, in a way, writing this book, I mean, as this being part of my livelihood, is like an example of that. Like this book only existed and I only got paid for it because I had a passion and an idea that was, again, different and outside the box. And I pushed for it and I can, you know, really stuck to my guns about doing this. And I always encourage students, like, don't be discouraged if what you want to do in your professional life is not listed on a job board or not advertised as an existing thing. Because the idea of job creation is not the easiest way to go, but maybe the most rewarding, where you can, you know, marry your passion and your skills is the sweet spot. And
right.
And I always encourage, like, I mean, honestly, like I've always been grateful that I know what I like, I know what I'm interested in, I know what I'm passionate about. Some people may not have that calling, but if you do have that calling, you know, find a way to make it happen, even if there isn't an obvious, you know, existing structure for it.
Yeah. And as someone that's worked in big companies, I guess my whole since graduating college, you know, there's unbelievable value for individuals that can come in and really kind of articulate and carve out, hey, this is a plan that I have that it's going to work here. Like companies want those things. Like they want those individuals that can do that, you know, right. Like not even the challenge of status quo, but just, hey, do you have a better method of how this has always gone? Cause most companies are like, this is just how to do it. This is how we've always done it. And that's it.
Right.
But that's not always the right, you know, there's so many opportunities for that. So any plans for another book? You think you want to do another one?
Yeah. I mean, not like a direct kind of sequel, but I have a lot of ideas. A lot of them in science. Also some shorter stuff. I mean, you know, there's some more long form articles I'd like to write. But I think what's challenging right now is that the type of reporting that I like to do is still not quite yet feasible, you know, with the pandemic. I mean, being able to travel and meet people and talk to people, you know, we're not quite there yet in terms of openness and vaccinations and everything. But once that comes back, then I feel like I can really start to do that again.
Yeah, that's terrific, man. Well, you seem like our kind of dude, man. If you're ever out in Philly, once this is all done, we can go get a beer at McGillin's or something.
Yeah. I was really bummed that, you know, I had this whole book tour plan last year that would have gone to Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
But now the paperback is going to come out next spring. So I'm hoping that if things are kind of normal next spring, maybe I'll do a version of that tour.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Love to go through Philadelphia.
Well, the book's called The Wax Pack for the, you know, the 200 people that normally listen to this, and 100 of them are probably from South Dakota, you know, that I'm related to or something. But yeah, man, we really appreciate the time and, you know, coming and doing this and answering our, you know, the email, and salute to you, man. We really enjoyed it.
I think I mentioned to you, I'm a big Dakotas fan.
Are you?
when I was, so talk about underdogs. So while growing up in Rhode Island, I would love going to the library, and they had like a book for every state. I was probably like 7 or 8 years old, and they had like a book for every state. I'd always check out the North Dakota book.
Oh yeah.
To me, North Dakota was the most fascinating, exotic place in the country. growing up in Rhode Island, because you never saw a North Dakota license plate, you know, never met anyone from North Dakota.
You don't.
It was built an underdog.
They don't go anywhere. I mean, why would you have to go anywhere? You got the land, you got oil.
Wasn't there like a movement to like change the name to just like Dakota or something?
Yeah, there was. And I mean, luckily that'll, and it's funny, I'm always so passionate about South Dakota, even though I have really no plans to ever go back there. But yeah, there is a big rivalry with, you know, with North Dakota State and South Dakota State. I went to South Dakota State, that has kind of come to fruition. And the level of ball is really, especially in football, it's such a high level. I mean, there's guys that get drafted, you know, multiple players like each year, you know, get drafted from both schools.
There must have been some baseball players that came out of South Dakota. Do you know any?
Mark Ellis for the Oakland A's. He was a second baseman. Jason Kubel was from Rapid City. He was kind of a power hitter for the Twins. Adam Vinatieri, the kicker, went to South Dakota State. He'll be a Hall of Famer.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Mike Miller.
One of the guys called him the idiot kicker. Was that?
Yeah. Well, I think he's still kicking.
Yeah.
You know, he's 40. He may have just retired, but it always blew me away when I had a work contract in Germany for 2 years. Everyone that I kind of met that was young, that followed sports, they all knew who Mike Miller was, and nobody in Europe knew who Derek Jeter was.
Wow.
That always blew me away. You know, they never heard of Derek Jeter, but yes, of course I know Mike Miller. You know, that was like, really?
Wow.
And I grew up, well, I was a smaller town than Mike was, but Mike was, you know, we'd go to camps and stuff together, and it was, you know, he was like 6'6", 6'7", like the tallest kid in the state, but like the best ball handler and the best shooter. You know, he just always looked different. I don't know any other baseball player. Oh, well, Terry Francona was born. Tito was born in Aberdeen. His dad played for the, I think Aberdeen used to have a minor league team. So yeah, there is some baseball guys that have come that way.
I would have enjoyed going there as part of the book, you know, to
some
reporting there. So
dollar beers and Chislik and chicken strips and fries for, you can have a whole night out and be like $18. You know, like just how we like it. So, well, all right, Brad, well, peace, my friend. Thanks for doing this. We appreciate it. It's great talking to you.
Thanks guys.
Have a great night, buddy.
Thank you.
Catch you later. See ya.
Rock chemistry. Rock chemistry.
Solo, get in the flow, and you can pitch it like a photo. Music makes mellow, maintains to make melodies for MCs, motivates to break some everlasting. I can go on for days and days with rhyme displays that engrave deep as x-rays. I can take a phrase that's rarely heard, flip it, now it's a daily word. I can get iller than armor, killing a bomb but no alarm. Rock him or remain calm, self-esteem make me super superb and supreme. Before a microphone, still I fiend. This was a tape, I wasn't supposed to break, I was supposed to wait, but let's motivate. I wanna see and keep following and swallowing, taking my name, biting and falling. Brothers try and others die to get the formula, but I'ma let you sweat, you still ain't warm. You a step away from frozen, stiff as if you're posing, digging to my brain as the rhyme gets chosen. So follow me, or what you're thinking you were first. Let's travel at magnificent speeds around the universe. What could you say as the earth gets further and further away? Planets are small, the balls of clay astray into the Milky Way. Worlds out of sight, far as the eye can see, not even a satellite. Now stop and turn around and look, as you stare in the darkness, your knowledge took. So keep staring, soon you suddenly see a star. You better follow it, cause it's the awe. This is a lesson if you're guessing and if you're borrowing. Hurry, hurry, step right up and keep following the leader.
Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry.
Keep following,
rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader.
This is a lifetime mission, vision of prison. I listen. In this journey, you're the journal, I'm the journalist. Am I eternal or an eternalist? I'm about to flow long as I could possibly go. Keep you moving cause the crowd says so, dance. Cuss, rip your pants, every beat on the blades bleeding to death, call an ambulance. Pull out my weapon and start to squeeze a magnum as a microphone, murdering MCs. Let's quote a rhyme from a record I wrote.
Follow the leader.
Yeah, don't. Cause every time I stop, it seems you're stuck. Soon as you try to step off, you're self-destruct. I came to overcome before I'm gone, by showing and proving and letting knowledge be born. Then after that, I'll live forever. You disagree, you say never, then follow me. From century to century, you remember me in history, not a mystery or a memory. I'm called by nature, mind raised in Asia. Since you was tricked, I have to raise ya from the cradle to the grave. But remember, you're not a slave, cause we was put here to be much more than that. But we couldn't see because our mind was trapped. But I'm here to break away the chains, take away the pains, remake the brains, rebuild my name. I guess nobody told you a little knowledge is dangerous. It can't be mixed, diluted, it can't be changed. The switch, here's a lesson if you're guessing and following. Hurry, hurry, step right up and keep following the leader.
Follow the leader, rock chemistry. 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 Follow the leader.
A verified freestyle, lyrics of fury. My third eye make me shine like jury. You're just a renter, rapping your rhymes a minute made. I'll be here when it fade, I watch it flip like a renegade. I can't wait to break and eliminate on every trade of a snake, so stay awake and follow, because the tempo's a trail. The stage is a cage, the mic is a third rail. I'm Rakim, the fiend of a microphone, I'm not him. So leave my mic alone, soon as the beat is felt, I'm ready to go. So fasten your seatbelt, cause I'm about to flow. No need to speed, slow down and let the leader lead. Word to daddy. Indeed, the R's a roller stone, so I'm rolling. Directions told them the rhymes are stolen. Stop bugging, a brother said dig him. I never dug him, he couldn't follow the leader long enough, so I drug him. Into danger zone, he should arrange his own. Face it, just basic, erase and change the tone. It's one R in the alphabet, it's a one letter word and it's about to get more complex from one rhyme to the next. Every D be easy on the flex. I've been from state to state, followers tailgate. Keep coming but you came too late, but I wait. So back up, regroup, get a grip, come equipped, you're the next contestant. Then clap your hands, you want a trip. The price is right, don't make a deal too soon. How many notes get your name this tune? Follow the leader is a title theme task. Now you know you don't have to act. Rap is rhythm and poetry, cuss create sound effects. You might catch up if you follow the records he wrecks. Until then, keep eating and swallowing. You better take a deep breath and keep following the leader.
Follow the leader, rock chemistry.
Keep following.
Rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry. Follow the leader, rock chemistry.
Rock. say peace.
Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry.
Follow the lead of
our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the lead of our chemistry. Follow the leader.
Follow the leader.